Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Hello. Thank you for joining us this evening. My name is Calvin Forbes. And it's my pleasure to serve as faculty liaison from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and as a member of the board of the Poetry Center of Chicago. This is our last reading of the season, and if you're not already on our mailing list, please sign up on your way out of the door tonight. Tonight our reader is Russell Banks. I first met Russell more than 20 years ago in Boston when we were both younger than we are now. And hanging out in the bars and cafes of Cambridge and Harvard Yard with other writers and artists talking about our craft, which for a writer means good talk. The conversation back then was often about the nature of the search for the American language, natural breath lines, I believe we called it, not too original, but still we were looking for the best American words and the best order. Nothing new, but we took it to heart. I have followed Russell Banks' writings since those days, and in my opinion, he just gets better and better, pursuing not only the ideal of writing the American language, but bringing the rhythm of American life deeply into the novels and short stories. His latest novel, Rule of the Bone, not surprisingly, was compared favorably in a recent New York Times book review to Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. High praise indeed. Russell Banks has published several books of poetry, short fiction, and novels. Some of the fiction titles include Family Life, The Book of Jamaica, Trailer Park, and The Sweet Hereafter. And most recently, as I mentioned, The Rule of the Bone. Join me in welcoming Russell to Chicago and to the Poetry Center of Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, pleasure to see Calvin again. We're both a little grayer and more grizzled than we were in the old days, but still doing the Australian crawl. And thank you for coming out on our rainy night. It's a pleasure to be here and to read for you. I'd like to read a chapter from Rule of the Bone that I should preface a little bit with a few remarks. The book is narrated by a 14-year-old boy from upstate New York, where I spend most of the year, who has become a homeless kid and has slipped sort of through the cracks into low-level drug dealing and minor crimes. And the first third of the book is set pretty much in and around the town of Plattsburgh, New York, where he is settled in a high-risk situation with a biker gang and still trying in some way to get back home again and get back into his family without becoming, as his mother insists, he become a different person. The middle third of the book is set, for the most part, in an abandoned school bus where he and a wandering child and now and then other kids have taken up residence, more or less under the tutelage of I think of him as a Rastafarian rascal, a kind of a man who takes the role of surrogate father and mentor for Bone. His original name is Chappie. He's now become Bone. That's a sort of a crossing over series of chapters that lead him from a boy struggling to get home and failing to a boy trying to become an adult on his own. He follows I-Man to Jamaica, and I-Man is an escaped migrant apple picker. from Jamaica, and he's left the Apple camp, and they manage somehow to get back down to Jamaica, where I-Man wants to return. And he takes up residence, Bone takes up residence with I-Man in Jamaica in the mountains. There are various other adventures and episodes which take place there, but the chapter I want to read is in Jamaica. And it's called Bone Goes Native. An essential theme of the book is race. And a boy trying to become, a white boy trying to become a moral adult in this society inevitably has to deal with that and inevitably has to come to some understanding of race that he wasn't given at in his childhood or by the society that surrounded him. And so Bone proceeds along the way to pass through various stages of that most of us have gone through to a greater or lesser degree, perhaps without recognizing it, and probably spread out over many years. In his case, it's very compressed and intensified. And this is an important stage, and very close to the late stages of coming to a coherent and moral understanding of race, his own and others, in a racialized world. But I want to emphasize that it's a stage. It's not by any means the final stage. It's the stage I think of as what the well-intended white folks get to and most often stop. It's sort of the identification with the victim stage, I think, if you had to give it a name. And Bone is moving into this stage, and this is a description of that. And I just say one more time that this is to be understood as that, a stage. He follows on beyond this, and other understanding comes to him through other events later. You'll have to imagine me as a 14-year-old boy. It was late the next afternoon before we finally got up to Akampong in the cockpit country, which turned out to be like I'd thought, I-Man's hometown that he'd been so homesick for back in the States. I-Man is the Rastafarian, as you may have guessed. It took about four different rides to hitch in because Akampong is a long ways from Mobay and not many people go there, so we had to spend a lot of time just chilling by the side of these winding country roads, and rode sometimes in the back of pickups and had to walk the last 4 or 5 miles uphill from the main road into the village. When we got there, it was sort of the way I'd pictured, basically a single dirt street with grass growing in the middle and a dozen or so cabins and small houses and a few more you could see scattered around in the jungle. And all these little veggie gardens and banana trees and kids running around in underpants and old guys snoozing in the shade of a breadfruit tree and goats and the occasional pig and females carrying baskets of yams on their heads or plastic pails of water from the well. One reason they call it cockpit country must be on account of the way the land looks. For miles and miles around, as far as you can see, they have like these huge deep craters or pits where the ground dropped out way back in ancient times. And they're all covered with trees and vines and thorn bushes and so on. And the people who live up in the cockpit are more like ridge runners than they are mountain climbers and don't like to go down into the craters unless they have to for a lost goat or kid, or to hide out from the cops or their other enemies. Due to the hundreds of caves down in the pits and the thickness of the bush, hiding out is basically what people have been doing up there for like hundreds of years, I-Man explained to me. The people who live there are called Maroons, he said, because of the reddish tint to their skin, which the truth is I couldn't see. They all look like regular black people to me, only darker. But they're all descended from these incredibly tough Africans who were called Ashantis, and after they were captured in Africa and shipped over to Jamaica, they escaped into the bush the first chance they had, and then kicked ass when the white slave catchers came after them, until finally the slave catchers said fuck it and went back to their sugar plantations on the coast and just let the Maroons live out there on their own and said, don't send us any more of those Ashanti warrior types. And that's when the Queen of England signed a peace treaty with a head Maroon whose name was Cujo. Nowadays, though, the place was full of ganja growers and miscellaneous criminals who were raised here and went to the city and fucked up and came back, plus some regular Jamaican farmers and such like. But they still pretty much lived like their Maroon ancestors and didn't have electricity or running water or TV or cars or any of the other modern conveniences. Also, a lot of Rastas had their groundations up there in the cockpit, And Iman said the real reason it's named Cockpit is because it's always been the place where the Rastafarian ascendants of the old African Ashanti warriors sat for control of the universe. All the way up from Mobe throughout the long night, after we'd made our escape from Papa Doc and the Great House, and while we chilled by the side of the road out of Mobe waiting for a ride, Iman was really into teaching me this stuff about the Maroons and Akampong and the old Ashanti warriors. Like he'd decided I was ready now to learn these things and use them in my daily life, even though I was still a white kid from America. But I was feeling weird and guilty from when I told Pa about how Iman hooked up with Evening Star, which was why we were on the run in the first place, and Iman wasn't making it any easier by treating me like his favorite student or something. I hadn't figured out yet why I'd done it, and I couldn't ask Iman the way I usually did when I couldn't figure something out. So I was slipping into blaming white people generally, and saying to myself, I must have done it because of my background in lying and betrayal that I learned as a child from my stepfather and other adults who all happened to be white. Iman'd be running on about the old Ashantis and the slave catchers and how they'd hunted the Ashantis down with these humongous man-eating dogs from Panama, and I'd be thinking, fucking Babylon, man. White people really suck. You can never trust them. Like that was letting me off the hook for almost getting Iman killed by my own father. There were maybe a few hundred people living in the village of Akampong, and a few hundred more living in the surrounding area. And everybody said they were Maroons and were related to everybody else, or that's how it seemed anyhow. And I guess it was true, because you couldn't be one without being the other. So the Maroons were like a tribe, you could say. They owned all the land in the Cockpit together and shared it on account of the treaty their great-grandfathers had signed with the Queen of England, more or less like the Mohawks at home and other American Indians. Except the Mohawks didn't call the Cockpit a reservation. It was more like an independent country called Akampong, inhabited and ruled exclusively by the Maroons, at least the way they talked about it, it was. They had a chief and everything, and even a Secretary of State, who were these really old guys that I saw a couple of times from a distance but never got to talk to, because Iman, right after we got there, set me up out in the bush far from the village where he had his groundation, and that's pretty much where I stayed. He didn't exactly say it, but Iman was protecting me, I think, by having me satar way out in the Cockpit, a couple of miles from the village, basically to watch over his ganja patch, which was pretty sizable. Hundreds of plants that I was also supposed to water from this spring way down in the bottom of the pit. But having white strangers or any kind of outsider camped in the village was definitely not encouraged, or at least that's the feeling I got from Iman, because when we first got there and he introduced me to a few people, like the woman he said was his kid's mother, not his wife, I noticed, or one of his cousins hanging in his yard, he'd say, "Bone, just be passing through." Plus, with his kids and all, he didn't have any room for me in his cabin. They only had two little rooms where everybody slept, all the kids on one bed and Iman and the kid's mother on another. Rest of the time, everybody hung in the yard where they cooked under a thatched roof on poles and sat around on little stools in an old car seat. Where I was wicked cool, though. Out there in a Cockpit up on a ridge with panoramic views and a cleared slope in front with these terraces where the ganja grew, I had my own cabin made out of bamboo with a thatched roof and a hammock for sleeping in, and a stone fireplace for cooking, and the necessary pots and other utensils, and lots of food around like breadfruit and yams and aki and coconuts and kalalu, plus stuff Iman brought out from the village that his old lady made. It was the best squat I'd ever had. I was happy. And besides, I think I needed it, being alone way out there with plenty of time to, like, think and remember things, except when in the evenings, mostly Iman had come out with a couple of his Rasta cousins, and they'd sit around and meditate over a chillum and do some African-style drumming on these excellent homemade drums and put out deep reflection until dawn some nights. Mainly, I'd hang back and watch and listen, because these were wicked heavy dudes who talked about killing guys down in Kingston and Mobe. And except for Iman, they weren't too interested in me and probably just thought I was some American white kid who was into weed that Iman was using as a watchdog. Which was basically true. I was a regular herb boy then, and I did work for Iman, who'd spent one whole day teaching me how to blow through a conch shell like a horn in case somebody tried to steal his crop. But there were other things in life that interested me even more than weed and watchdogging I-Man's crop. And I-Man knew that. So lots of times he'd come out to the groundation alone or with one of his picnies, he called them, his kids, of which he had four. And after he'd checked his plants and talked to them a while and done some weeding and nipping the buds and shown me some new tricks of the ganja grower's trade and so on, he'd satire in the yard by the cabin and rasta rap his way through another chapter in the history of the African captivity in Babylon. By this time, my hair was pretty long, down to my shoulders and in my eyes, and I had this nervous habit when I was thinking of twirling it with my fingers. And one day, in the middle of telling me about how Marcus Garvey'd been poisoned by the capitalists for trying to take the Africans back to the promised land in their own ark, I-Man noticed me doing it and got up and went into the bush and came back with a bunch of leaves that he crushed and squeezed some juice out of and said to rub into my locks. The juice smelled like licorice, but it worked, because the next day when I woke up, I had regular dreadlocks growing. Not big time, but these loose, springy, dark, reddish-brown locks about a foot long that I couldn't really check out since I didn't have a mirror, but I could feel them and could tell they were cool-looking. Also, I'd only been wearing shorts out there on the groundation and no shirt, and had gotten real tanned. So this one day I was standing alone dribbling water from a pail onto the plants like I-Man showed me, and I flipped my head to chase off a mosquito and saw dreadlocks swirling through the air in my shadow. Then I looked down at my arms and hands, which were like coffee-colored. And when I saw I didn't look like a regular white kid anymore, I put down the bucket and did a little rasta dance right there in the sunshine. It's funny how when you change the way you look on the outside, even if it's only with a tattoo, you feel different on the inside. I was learning that it's true what I-Man said. If you work at it long enough and are serious, you can become a brand new beggar. I'd even started talking different, not saying cool and excellent to everything anymore, but instead I'd go, "Irie, man." And when I used to refer to myself only as I or me, now I said, "I and I," which makes you feel slightly separate from your body. It makes you feel that your true self is like this spirit that can float through the air where it communes with the universe, and it can even travel backward and forward in time. All the drumming and long meditation and all the late night reflection sessions with the Maroons and their Ashanti ascendants who were with us in spirit, like I-Man said, and the detailed instruction in history and daily life I was getting from I-Man, plus the regular partaking of the sacrament of Kali at the Chilam with the Rastas and the everyday solitary exploration of I-Self I'd been doing with the assistance of excellent weed ever since the first day I met I-Man at the school bus in Plattsburgh. All this had been having a deep gradual effect on me without my actually knowing it, until one morning I woke up in my hammock and looked up at the thatched roof overhead, and I knew I'd like finally cast off my old self and was lying naked in the universe as the day I was born 15 years ago in Aussable, New York, United States of America, planet Earth. And then on the night of the full moon, when the ganja plants were taller than my head and were supposed to be harvested the next day, I-Man and three of his Rasta brethren from Akampong came out to the groundation, all serious and carrying machetes. And when they told me they were taking me to the secret maroon cave for seeing the true lights of I-Self, I was ready, man. I was fucking ready. In the old days, I probably would have said cool or whatever, and maybe tried to postpone the whole thing without them knowing I was scared. But now I just said, "That be Irie," and followed I-Man in the moonlight straight into the bush with the brethren coming along behind and no one talking. It wasn't like I wanted to be made into an honorary Negro or anything. The truth is, I really believed in wisdom then, that there actually was such a thing, I mean, and a few people had it, like I-Man mainly, and under the right conditions they could pass it on even to a kid. And I believed, with my background and being a white American and all, I especially needed some wisdom if I was going to grow up and be better at living my life than most of the adults I'd known so far were. We didn't seem to be walking on a regular path, and sometimes I-Man had to hack the maca bushes away before we could pass through one cockpit and climb over the ridge and descend into another. But I guess we were on some kind of known path, because I-Man didn't hesitate any or change his mind about this way or that. We walked for hours, it seemed like, up steep inclines and zigzags and then down again, until I started feeling like I was on a whole other continent than the one I'd lived on all my life, like I was in Africa. I knew the brethren pretty good by then, Teron and Elroy and Rubber, who were in their 30s or 40s, older Rastas with wicked massy dreads. Teron and Elroy were I-Man's cousins and like junior partners in his groundation. And Rubber, whose name came from his face, which he could twist into all these different expressions anytime he wanted, but mostly looked sad, was his nephew and had his own groundation in the cockpit next to I-Man's. They were heavy dudes, darker and fiercer than the ant farm posse, expert machete men with great bills who looked like they could pull your arms out if they wanted. I-Man, who was a tiny old guy compared to them, they treated with total respect. And Teron once told me that someday I-Man, when he ascended into the fullness of his age and completed his trampoosing amongst the various peoples of the world, would probably become the chief of the Maroons in Akampong, or at least the Secretary of State. Finally, we were way down in the bottom of one of the cockpits where the moonlight couldn't reach, and you couldn't even see the stars. And I was just following I-Man in pitch darkness by the sound of his footsteps now. Then suddenly I couldn't hear him anymore, so I stopped, and after a few seconds I said, "Yo, I-Man, where you at?" Rubber, who was right behind me, said, "Keep moving, Rasta." "But I and I can't see nothing." "No matter, man," he said, and gave me a little push on the shoulder with the tip of his machete, and that got me going again. On and on I walked in total darkness, like for a quarter of a mile maybe, thinking, well, if I walk off a cliff, I won't know it till it's too late, so why worry? When I noticed that the air had gotten cool like a fan was blowing, and I could feel through my sandals that I was walking on smooth, flat rock now, not dirt or grass anymore, and I could hear water dripping. I knew I must be in a cave, but it was like I had a blindfold on. And I started imagining bats and snakes and shit darting at me out of the darkness, and my skin got goosebumped all over. And for a second there, I was scared I'd lose it completely and start trying to claw my way back out to the moonlight. And for the rest of my life, I'd have to live with the shameful knowledge that I'd panicked at the very moment I was supposed to be viewing the lights of I-Self and ascending in that eerie glow to the heights of I-N-I, where I'd finally come to know Jah. I heard a match then and saw the flame and I-Man's craggy brown face as he lit up a spliff and took a deep hit off of it, and with the same match lit a candle and then took it and went around lighting more candles that were in these nooks and crannies in the walls of the cave. The darkness disappeared and tall shadows flashed and fell all around like I-Man was dropping solid dark gray wool blankets off of a clothesline and revealing behind them this humongous room with yellowish-white rock walls that were curved and smooth like they'd been carved out of solid rock by water over millions of years. It was like being inside a gigantic human skull, and we'd come in through the mouth. Up above, there were a couple more dark caves leading out that looked like eye sockets, and in back, where I guess the spinal column was, I could see another dark hole. And I could hear water running down there like that was the ancient riverbed, and it was still carving its way deeper and deeper into the earth. I-Man sat me down on a little ledge and sat beside me and pointed out a bunch of red pictures up on the top of the skull of these weird squiggly signs and a couple of animals I recognized, like turtles and birds and snakes and stick figures of guys with spears who were fighting each other, some lying down with the spears sticking out and some with their heads cut off and the rest wailing on them. The pictures were way up on top, higher than you could reach without an extension ladder, which they didn't have in those olden days, so I wondered how they got up there to paint them. "Dem fly up bone," I-Man said. "Dem old Africans could fly like birds, man." I figured there'd be some kind of ceremony now, and I was really hoping it wouldn't involve any cutting and blood. But I'd come this far without turning back and was ready to go the whole route no matter what the drill was. So I was really relieved when Rubber reaches into the cloth bag where I'd been thinking they had the knives and bowls for collecting blood or whatever, and instead he pulled out this cool woman sitting with her legs crossed and her arms folded onto her huge tits, and I-Man immediately fills it from a pouch and says, "This be some special herb bone," and lights it. He passed the chillum down to Teron and Elroy and Rubber, who all took huge hits, and then to me, and I gave it my usual medium-sized whack and passed it on to I-Man. But before the tube had even reached I-Man's mouth, I felt myself whirling like in a barrel going over a waterfall. And for a second, it was completely dark again, and I couldn't see anything except I knew I was still spinning in the barrel. Then my eyesight came back, and I was in a totally different place than the cave, and with different people. I'm remembering it now while I'm telling it, so I'm like in two places at once, here and now, and then and there. But when it was happening, I was only in the one place, which was not a limestone cave in cockpit country in Jamaica with I-Man and his Rasta brethren. And it wasn't like any tripping on acid I've ever done, where you're also in two places at once, and one of them is weird and the other normal. Even dreaming, you're usually in two places at once. No, this was like real, and I didn't have any memory of how I got there or any plans for getting out. A drum was beating, real heavy and slow, like thump, 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 and it didn't let up or change. It just went on and on, a sort of soundtrack on a continuous loop that seemed to come from the place itself the way the sound of the wind does, like it was coming right out of the trees and fields and sky and not from outside. I wasn't scared or anything yet. I just went with it and discovered one thing at a time and dealt with it, like the fact that I was up on a wagon driving a team of oxen, I guess they are, like cows, only bigger, slowly along a lane that cuts across a wide green cane field, and my wagon is heaped up with cane stalks. There's the sea in the distance, with waves breaking on a thin sandy beach and rocky ledges further on, and a bright blue sky overhead, and a burning sun, and behind me the dark green mountains. I'm all alone out there in my wagon, and it's hot under the noonday sun, and it takes me a long time to get across the cane field to the line of trees at the edge, and when I pass into the shade of the trees, it's cooler, and a light breeze blows, and I'm pretty happy for a few minutes then. There's a little stream flowing by, and where the trail crosses it, I stop the wagon and let the oxen drink from it, and drink a little myself and wet my do-rag and wipe my face with it. Then I get back up on the wagon box and drive on and cross some more cane fields until finally I come into this little town where there's a regular stone church and some stores and so on, and lots of people walking around, mostly black people, barefoot and in work clothes, and a few white people dressed more or less the same, until I get to the town square, where there's more white people than black now, and the whites are wearing straw hats and these old-fashioned suits. Nobody pays any attention to me, so I go by real slow and try to catch the scene, although it makes me feel ashamed, and I don't want to look, but I do. The white people are buying and selling black people. A white guy up on a kind of stage in the middle is showing off a naked, scared-looking black kid about my age, making him turn around and bend over and spread his cheeks and show his ass and balls to the crowd, which has a fair number of females in it. And different whites in the crowd are bidding on the kid, while another white guy off to the side of the stage, the auctioneer, I guess, points to this or that bidder and keeps the price going up. Everybody acts like it's normal, even the black people. Little picnic kids are running around, and black women are carrying bundles on their heads, and white men are smoking cigars and talking. Nobody's crying or looking embarrassed or pissed off. Everybody's relaxed and easy and familiar with each other, white and black alike, although obviously the whites are the bosses and tell the blacks to do this or that, which they do, but not too fast. The auctioneer, who's a tall, skinny, hawk-faced guy like Pa, makes the naked kid on the stage squat down and jump like a frog, and everybody laughs, even the few blacks who are among the crowd, although there's a line of other blacks I now see standing on the ground behind the stage, men and women and some kids and babies, all of them naked, even the older ones, and they're all chained together at the ankles and scabby and sorrowful, and none of them laughs at the kid leaping around on the stage like a shiny black frog. I guess they're still Africans, and to them this isn't normal yet. The whole scene creeps me out, so I give a little flick of the stick and keep my oxen moving on out of town along the track, keeping close to the sea for a while. After a few minutes, I don't have any complicated thoughts or memories anymore, or even any stupid or simple thoughts. I'm just catching the rays up on my box and digging the smell of the cane and the feel of the light sea breeze on my face, and now and then brushing a fly away and letting the oxen make all the decisions. The track turns gradually uphill between more cane fields until I come to a big stone gate and turn in and drive the wagon up to a bunch of buildings like barns where there's a dozen or so black dudes and some women unloading cane from different wagons and carrying it inside this one barn and stacking it. There's also this huge grinder with a blindfolded ox hitched to a long pole going around in a permanent circle, and a building with a tall brick chimney sending up a cloud of white, sweet-smelling smoke, and various other smaller buildings, offices and workshops and the such. It's a sugar factory, and as soon as I pull up in my wagon, a bunch of older guys and women and teenaged kids, all blacks and really sweaty and filthy, come over and start to unload it. Nobody talks. They just work. I don't know what to do now, so I'm just sitting there waiting for instructions, or maybe the oxen will know what to do, when I notice off to my right a white man wailing on a black woman with a short whip. He's got her shirt pulled off, and she's down on her hands and knees on the ground, and every time he hits her, her tits shudder, and all the time I can hear the same drum thumping like before, only now it's in time to the whip coming down. The white guy is all sweaty and has a mustache like my stepfather, although it's not quite him. And he's going about his business whipping the woman like he's splitting wood. Nothing personal or emotional about it, just part of the job. I look around and the other black people are all going about their business too, just part of the job. Then suddenly somebody grabs my arm and yanks me down from the wagon to the ground. It's another white guy, shirtless and young, like in his 20s or so, and tough-looking, with muscles and a hairless chest with great definition, like old Bruce, but no tattoos or nipple rings or anything. For a second, the blacks stop working and look at me, but then they turn away and go back to work. The white guy's got kind of a blonde buzz cut and good teeth, and he reaches down, clamps his hand onto my arm, and yanks me up from the ground like I don't weigh anything, which compared to him, I don't. And without saying anything, he drags me around behind one of the barns like I'm a chicken, and he's got to cut my head off for the cook. When we get back there out of sight of the others, the white guy unbuttons his pants and flings a huge boner out, which he makes me jerk off with my hand while he holds me next to him real tight. And when he comes, he gasps and kisses me hard on the back of my neck. Then he stuffs his unit back into his pants and buttons up and shoves me back in the direction of the wagons and the other people and follows along behind like nothing happened. I'm actually pretty relieved that nothing worse happened, but I'm feeling pretty shitty anyhow, so I'm glad to see that my wagon's empty. And when I climb back up onto the box, the oxen turn and move back down the long curving driveway between the cane fields to the road by the sea the same way as we came before. All day long it goes like that, real slow and mindless in the sun when I'm alone with the oxen driving the wagon across the cane fields and while the wagon's being loaded or unloaded. But then as soon as I'm around white people, everything gets crazy and speeded up and violent. I see an old black guy get kicked in the balls by a white man who then throws a bucket of cold water on him and walks away. I see two white guys screaming at each other, the cords in their necks sticking out and spit flying, while a young, good-looking black female stands off to one side looking at the ground and waiting. I see a white man in a suit and broad-brimmed hat galloping toward me on horseback, and I pull my oxen out of his way into a cane field, and the wagon smashes some of the cane while he races past, and afterwards another white guy comes running out of the field and beats the shit out of me with a bamboo cane and calls me a fucking idiot. I see a black man hanging from a tree at the edge of town and white kids throwing stones at his body and John Crow birds waiting in the top branches of the tree for the kids to get bored and go away. And at night, after everybody's come in from the fields and most of the blacks have gone to their cabins behind the great house, which is a lot like Starport but not as fancy and not up in the hills, I have to carry food and drinks to the white people at their table who talk like I can't understand English and don't know that all they talk about is how lazy and stupid and dishonest the blacks are. There are four or five men. I can't remember them all individually because they kind of blend together. And whenever I'm around them, I'm scared and feel shitty, or else I'm trying to get away from them. But they're related, fathers and sons and brothers. Plus there are a couple of females, a wife and mother of the sons, and a younger one who's either a sister or else is married to one of the sons. And there's some little white kids I try to ignore, except when they tell me to bring them something or take something away.
Later, the men sit out on the porch looking across the fields in front to the sea sparkling in the moonlight, and I'm supposed to stand behind them and wave this palm leaf to keep the mosquitoes away while they drink and smoke and worry about money and slaves and tell weird stories about the sex lives of black people until finally they say they're going to bed and they stumble off and leave me by myself. With the white people gone, I don't know what to do next, so I wander around the big empty house for a while and then go outside and start toward the slave quarters and back, when all of a sudden, standing in the path in front of me, there's I-Man and his maroon brethren, Teron and Elroy and Rubber, all of them carrying machetes and looking serious. There's blood on the machetes and a big splash of blood across Rubber's shirt. Before I can say anything, I-Man puts his finger to his lips to shush me. Then I see behind them in the shadows a bunch more black people, mostly men, but some women too, with little kids even. The black people I've been seeing all day out in the fields and at the sugar factory and up in the great house. The woman who was being whipped and the old guy who got kicked and the young woman the two overseers were fighting over. All the people who were working alongside me like silent machines without any thoughts or feelings. They're carrying machetes too, plus scythes and sickles and hatchets, and they quickly brush past me, following I-Man and the other maroons toward the great house. I want to follow them, but something stops me, like my feet are suddenly made of lead and I can't walk, so I have to stand there in the bushy shadows at the edge of the big wide lawn and watch the blacks enter the darkened house at all the entrances, front and back and side. Except for the steady drumming, which I'm totally used to by now, like it's my own heartbeat, and the sound of the wind off the sea, clattering the moonlit palms, it's completely silent. I stand there for a long time wondering if maybe I was dreaming, when I hear a shriek that makes my blood go cold, followed by screams and someone, a woman, wailing for a second until she's abruptly shut off, and then a white man is begging, "No, no, please don't." And he's cut off too. Then silence again, until I hear some glass breaking inside. And then I notice someone, a child, creeping on hands and knees across the porch in front. It's a blonde-haired white boy, barefoot in a nightgown, like 5 or 6 years old. And he makes his way along the length of the porch and climbs down to the ground there and starts running straight toward where I'm standing. He comes up suddenly on me, all wild-eyed and pumping his arms and legs like mad, and just as he's about to pass me by, I reach out and grab him and clap my hand over his shocked mouth and pull him back into the shadowy bushes and hold on to him tight. A minute later, I can see flames flaring up at the back of the house, and up on the second floor, somebody's smashing the windows and tossing stuff out, books fluttering down and dishes and piss pots and a tailor's dummy. The drapes on the first floor are on fire now, and I can see black people with their machetes and so on coming out of the house and gathering together on the far side. Me and the white kid, who's shivering in my arms, back off a few more steps into the bushes as the blacks check each other out and then start running. There's about 20 or 30 of them, waving bloody machetes and hatchets as they cross the great wide lawn in the moonlight, headed toward a grove of live oak trees and a long sloping field where the cows are kept. The house is really on fire now. Huge sprays of sparks are flying up, and the sky is glowing orange and yellow. Behind me, the long driveway curves away to the road by the sea, and I see in the distance the first of the white men on horseback coming, with a second batch a short ways behind. The blacks have disappeared into the cow field, and beyond the field is the woods, and then the hills, and beyond the hills is the cockpit. There's no one left here now. No one alive but me and the little blonde-haired white kid sobbing in my arms. And here come the white men riding up the driveway like mad with guns and swords glinting in the moonlight, ready to slay the first black they see. They're hungry for killing a black and spattering his blood, and no little white kid is going to be strong enough to save him. Suddenly someone touches me on the shoulder and I turn, and it's I-Man. He says, "Come in, Bone." "What about him?" I say, and show him the little white kid. "Forgetty, Bone." Crying, practically crying, I say, "Oh, Rasta, I and I can't do that." "Up to you, Bone," he says, and he walks off toward the bush and disappears into the darkness. I unwrap my arms from the white boy and release him And instantly he takes off running toward the men on horseback who have arrived in front of the house now and are shouting and firing their guns into the air, looking crazy and wild until they see the kid. The head white man gets down off his horse real fast and sweeps the boy up in his arms. And right away, the kid points straight at where I'm hiding in the bushes. The little bastard betrays me. The head white guy starts jogging toward me with his gun out, ready to blow me away, and several others come up behind him. So I take off running, darting down behind the barns and the sugar factory, where I scramble over a stone fence and plunge into the cane field there, with bullets flying over my head and zipping through the cane, snapping off stalks as I plow ahead like in a green, endless, head-high sea of sugar cane, expecting my next breath to be my last. But it's not. Way out there in the middle of the cane field, with my chest heaving and my legs almost too heavy to run another step, I push away a clump of cane and see a hole in the ground. Quick as I can, I check it out and observe that it goes a long ways in and is just big enough for a skinny kid like me to squeeze into, but no regular white man can. I take one more look back at the great house, which is all aflame now, and the white guys are riding around it like they set it on fire themselves, shooting their guns off in all directions, even in mine still. Then I notice that a bunch of riders are torching the cane field on three sides, and a bunch more are galloping their horses around to the fourth side by the road to wait there for me. So I drop down on my hands and knees and crawl into the darkness of the hole in the ground. I'm surprised and a little scared to find that the hole just keeps going. It's a tunnel, and pretty soon it's pitch dark, and I can't hear the gunfire and the roar of the fires and the white guys yelling anymore. All I can hear is the drumming, the same drumming as before, only it's getting louder now as I crawl along the tunnel, feeling my way with my hands out in front of my face. I squirm and crawl like this for hours, it seems like, and all the time the drums keep getting louder, until finally I work my way around a sharp bend in the tunnel, and up ahead I catch a glimpse of a flickering light, and before I know it, I've reached the end of the tunnel. I pull myself forward and up out of it, and when I stick my head up and look around, I see that I've come out in the candlelit maroon cave. I climb up out of the spinal cord hole at the rear of the skull, and there's I-Man kicking back with a spliff, and old Rubber's working out like a madman on one of those little square goatskin drums. And the other Rastas, Teron and Elroy, are rolling joints. And everybody looks like, even though they've been waiting patiently for me to get back, they're relieved to see me and are ready to book. Rubber lays off the drumming and stands and stretches, and the other guys do the same. Then I-Man blows out the candles one by one and leads the way back out through the mouth into the darkness. And then he goes on.